Hello, and welcome to Science World. This past Thursday, the U.S. Space Agency unveiled the first images from the Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph study of the Sun. Suzanne Presto will tell us more. We hear about new research that predicts that if large amounts of methane are released from thawing permafrost in the Arctic, the world could wind up paying out an incredible amount of money. And a report from the UK's Oxford University finds that Mars may have had an oxygen-rich atmosphere nearly 1.5 billion years before the Earth did. We'll talk with one of the scientists who led the research. This and much more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health and Technology magazine, Science World. A solar observatory that was launched 1 month ago is already giving scientists an unprecedented glimpse of the sun. Suzanne Presto in Washington has more about NASA's Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph, known as IRIS.
The IRIS satellite looks at the little-understood lowest layers of the sun's atmosphere. Its detailed first images were unveiled to the public on Thursday and show an active, dynamic region. The U.S. Space Agency describes spots that quickly brighten and dim, and thread-like towers of energy that reveal major temperature differences in the sun's lower atmosphere. John Grunsfeld of NASA's Science Mission Directorate in Washington described the moment on July 17th when the Solar Observatory's telescope caught its first glimpse of the sun.
When the aperture door opened, it was truly a grand opening of a new era of solar physics to be able to understand this interface region that's a crucial link in that story of unraveling the mysteries of the sun.
Among those mysteries is just how the sun's upper atmosphere is so much hotter than its surface, even though it's farther from the sun's heat-generating core. IRIS is observing the way solar material gathers energy and heats up as it rises through the sun's lower atmosphere. Bart DePontu, an IRIS researcher based at Lockheed Martin's Advanced Technology Center in California, says scientists have compared computer simulations and the data they've collected from IRIS.
We've been struck by the similarities of what IRIS sees, but we also already know that there are differences that are puzzling us. And actually, that's where we get excited, because it's these discrepancies that tell us that we're missing something in our understanding.
DePontu says scientists hope to observe large explosions on the sun that can disrupt technology here on Earth, as well as the less dramatic solar moments that affect near-Earth space and our climate. The $181 million IRIS mission is set to last 2 years, but scientists say the Solar Explorer could function much longer. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
There are about 7,000 languages in the world, and half of them could disappear by the end of the century. But an effort called the Rosetta Project is preserving a key to understanding them for future generations. Mike O'Sullivan has more from San Francisco.
San Francisco, c'est un peu bizarre pour moi. Moi, je préférais quand même avoir un vrai été, mais bon, ici c'est.
These two American linguistics students can speak multiple languages, including French. They are among a dozen taking part in a summer internship at the Rosetta Project, working with professional linguists to expand a digital record of endangered languages. It's inspired by the Rosetta Stone, which contained an ancient inscription in Greek and two different Egyptian writing systems, providing scholars with the first key to understanding Egyptian hieroglyphics. Started by a nonprofit group called the Long Now Foundation, the project is creating an online archive and is also preserving parallel texts on an optical disk, a kind of Rosetta Stone for linguists in the future. The small handheld disk is etched with tiny print and plated with nickel. There are 13,000 pages, sampling 1,500 languages in microscopic text, says the foundation's Alexander Rose.
A single parallel text, a description, a map of where it's from, these types of things that just give you enough that you can compare to maybe another language that you know or have studied or scholars have figured out, that you can start pulling parallels between the two and reconstruct the basics of a language.
A recent demonstration of endangered languages, sponsored by the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, featured the Hawaiian language and other vanishing tongues, including Tuvan, which can still be heard in southern Siberia. Many languages like this are spoken by small groups, says Rosetta Project Director Laura Welcher.
They're spoken by thousands of people or even smaller sized groups. And a lot of those languages are in remote parts of the world. They haven't all been well documented.
Linguists at universities and research institutes are in a race against time to record these languages before they die out. And linguists and students at the Rosetta Project are doing their part, says Laura Welcher.
So the idea is to purposely create a very massively parallel linguistic collection that's broadly representative of all of our human languages. That could be that kind of secret decoder ring for human languages and what we leave for the future.
And it may be the key to helping reconstruct today's dying languages. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, San Francisco.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. With potentially huge amounts of untapped gas and oil reserves in the Arctic, industries have long eyed the Arctic ice melt as a boon for profits. But a new study says the release of large amounts of methane from thawing permafrost in the Arctic could cost the global economy trillions of dollars. Sayla Hennessy reports from London.
Scientists from Cambridge and Rotterdam studied analysis that has so far been done of methane emissions in the East Siberian Sea. They estimated the release of 50 billion tons of methane over the course of a decade could result in an estimated $60 trillion economic loss. Chris Hope from the University of Cambridge is a specialist advisor on the economics of climate change. He co-authored the report.
The impacts will be felt about 80% in developing countries and only about 20% in the countries like the US and the European Union, which are rather better off.
For example, he says, in regions of sub-Saharan Africa, where agriculture is only marginally possible today, it could become impossible to farm in a productive way. Rising sea levels and increasing storms might cause destruction to places like Bangladesh. Those potential results need to be taken into account when governments and industries consider the effects of a warming Arctic. Cambridge University Polar Ocean Physics Group leader Peter Wadhams co-authored the report, which is published in the journal Nature. He says the release of methane into the atmosphere could be devastating. It's a powerful greenhouse gas responsible, he says, for one quarter of global warming, and yet there's little that can be done right now to prevent it from leaking out.
To stop the methane emission, you've got to stop the melting, the thawing of the seabed permafrost. And the only way to do that really is to bring back the sea ice so that it keeps the water cold. And the only real way to bring back the sea ice is to cool the climate.
Wadhams says governments and international groups should be investing money and resources into finding a solution for Arctic thawing. But he says scientists are a long way from there.
At the present state of research on geoengineering, it's difficult to see any technique that can be targeted on a particular region. Most of the ideas that have been put forward for geoengineering would be applied to the entire planet rather than a small region.
It's believed the Arctic contains about 30% of the world's undiscovered gas and almost 15% of untapped oil. Sayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. We just heard a report about permafrost. By definition, permafrost is ground that remains frozen for two or more years. Now, there's a form of permafrost that exists under the sea in ocean sediments. What is that called? Is it A, oceanic permafrost, B, subsea permafrost, or C, suboceanic freezing? You think you have the right answer? Well, stick around. The correct answer is coming up in just a little bit. Google has been selling its newest high-tech device, Google Glass, to a select group to test the technology so it can be improved for the mass market. Elizabeth Lee reports that the biggest criticism of the device has been about privacy.
When Professor Marcia Dawkins first heard about Google Glass, she had only one thought.
I thought, this is something I definitely need for my classroom and hopefully for my personal life too.
Dawkins' Google Glass looks like a pair of bright orange glasses without lenses, but there's a tiny rectangular glass at the top right-hand corner of her orange frame. Through that glass, Dawkins has been recording video while biking.
This is biking in Brooklyn, New York.
She's also been able to talk to her sister in Thailand with Google Glass. She's planning to use the device in her classroom to teach a public speaking class in the coming year. Dawkins also wants to record her lectures with Google Glass to allow her students to see what she sees.
You know, I often tell them at the beginning of the term, if you can see me, I can see you, but they never believe me. They think they're invisible when they're behind the laptops.
But not everyone embraces this new technology. John Simpson is director of the Privacy Project with a public interest group consumer watchdog.
It's essentially going to allow people to come in and spy on you and record that without you knowing what's going on.
But Google's Chris Dale says the device is designed to address that concern.
In order to activate the camera or to record a video, you have to take an explicit gesture say something out loud. So I activate the device, I say, OK, Glass, take a picture. Similarly, I have a little button on the top here that I can push that will, again, show an explicit gesture to everybody around me. That a picture is being taken or a video is being recorded.
But filmmaker Chris Barrett showed just how easy it is to record people without them knowing. His Glass captured a man getting arrested at a fight at a fireworks show. He posted the video to YouTube. Mike DiGiovanni created a way to take pictures with just a wink. Hackers have been able to get facial recognition technology to run on Glass. The technology can scan a face, identify the person, and provide information about that person. Google says it will not approve face recognition applications, but consumer watchdog's John Simpson says it may be up to Congress to protect people's privacy.
I think it's going to require some serious legislation. We're going to have to pass some laws.
Marcia Dawkins says privacy concerns will be a part of her classroom discussion as she uses Glass to enhance her students' learning experience. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science. People have complained about a poor night's sleep during a full moon. Now, a new study has found evidence that Earth's closest galactic neighbor appears to impact the quality of sleep in humans. Jessica Berman has more.
Christian Kaiochin, a sleep researcher at the Psychiatric Hospital of the University of Basel, Switzerland, led a study analyzing sleep study data measurements, including brain activity, of 33 individuals who had previously been assessed in a sleep clinic. To their surprise, Kaiochin says researchers found the subjects slept more poorly when the moon was full.
Around full moon, people had less deep sleep. About 30% less deep sleep. They slept in general 20 minutes shorter, and it took them 5 minutes longer to fall asleep.
Kaiochin says little is known about the impact of moon phases on humans, whose sleep is influenced by a 24-hour internal clock called a circadian rhythm, a biological process driven by hormone fluctuations that control the sleep-wake cycle and feeding patterns. This internal clock is also influenced by periods of light and dark, according to Kaiochin, who says researchers found that levels of the hormone melatonin, which readies the body for sleep, were also lower in subjects during a full moon.
There is darkness outside, and our body has to adapt to darkness behavior, which means in humans, sleep. So it's a sleep preparatory hormone. And this was reduced during full moon phase, although they didn't see the light, and this probably caused this little sleep disturbance.
Kaiochin speculates the sleep disturbance, which is due to what he calls a circa-lunar rhythm, might be a holdover from prehistoric times, influencing human reproduction and other activities as it now does in animals, including sea creatures.
There is evidence that these two clocks talk to each other, the circadian and the circa-lunar clock, in other species, but we don't have any clue in humans, first of all, whether there is a clock, a circa-lunar clock, and when yes, where is the clock, you know, where in the brain. We know it about the circadian clock. We know exactly the location where it is for the circadian clock, but the circa-lunar clock is still mysterious.
Kaiochin says a lunar clock, if it exists, may also influence cognitive performance in humans and our moods. An article on the influence of the moon on human sleep is published in the journal Current Biology. I'm Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Every year, biologists in Alaska launch the Salmon Cam, an underwater video camera that streams live video of salmon in their summer journey upstream. Megan McGrath explains why you may want to watch it.
In streams winding through Alaska's Tongass National Forest, the largest national forest in the United States, the salmon are running. They do this every year, the adult fish struggle upstream, sometimes hundreds of kilometers from the ocean. They are going back to the freshwater stream beds where they hatched years earlier. There they will mate, lay their own eggs, and die. Every year, the U.S. Forest Service puts a camera in the water to capture the salmon's journey.
These fish come right up to the camera sometimes, or you get to see how they chase other fish away, or you can see them digging their nests in the rocks and gravel. You can be in their level and look at them almost eye to eye.
Tongass National Forest biologist Pete Schneider has been running the salmon cam every year since 1997. This year, he has put it in Steep Creek, where sockeye salmon mate and lay their eggs. Check out the salmon cam at the VOA website or on the Forest Service YouTube page. You can watch the bright red and green sockeye pairing up and swimming endlessly against the stream's current. Schneider says sockeye is a particularly delicious species of salmon.
Their meat is highly prized. It keeps very well, so a lot of the native tribes would seek out sockeye in particular because it cans and smokes very well.
And bears agree. After the salmon have spawned, they die in Steep Creek, and the forest predators all come to the stream for the feast. Along with the grizzly bears, bald eagles and even wolves thrive on the fish. But salmon are also an important food source for the entire coastal ecosystem.
It goes beyond just the eagle and the bear and the humans. It really feeds the insects and the plants, and the soils benefit from it, and all the microbes and invertebrates. They all indirectly benefit from the salmon.
The salmon's bodies fertilize the stream's banks and nourish the forest. Later, when the eggs hatch, small fish and animals will feed on the fry. The young salmon travel downstream to the ocean, where they become prey for larger fish, seagulls, seals, whales, and fishermen. In a few years, the cycle will start again as the surviving salmon battle upstream once more. Megan McGrath, VOA News, Washington.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Now, there's a form of permafrost that exists under the sea in ocean sediments. We wanted to know what it was called. Is it A, ocean permafrost, B, subsea permafrost, or C, suboceanic freezing? Well, answers A, oceanic permafrost, and C, suboceanic freezing are incorrect. The correct answer is B, subsea permafrost. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, subsea, or offshore permafrost, refers to permafrost occurring beneath the seabed, and it exists in continental shelves of the polar regions. Subsea permafrost is formed because of either consistently freezing temperatures on the sea bottom, or because the sea level was raised high enough that terrestrial permafrost was covered by seawater. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week. New research by scientists at Oxford University has revealed that Mars may have also had an oxygen-rich atmosphere 4 billion years ago, nearly 1.5 billion years before Earth developed its own atmospheric oxygen. The scientists, led by Professor Bernard Wood, studied the chemical composition of Martian meteorites that fell to Earth, which they say probably came from deep within the interior of Mars. They then made a similar examination of rocks that were found on the surface of Mars with data provided by NASA's Spirit rover. Now, after comparing the composition of both forms of Martian rock, they found that those from the surface came from a more oxygen-rich environment. Professor Wood joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research and findings. We first wanted to know what differences he found in Martian rocks that came to Earth as meteorites and those found on the surface of Mars by the rover Spirit.
The principal difference in the chemical composition between the surface rocks that were analyzed by the Spirit rover and the Martian meteorites, which of course have landed here on Earth, is the concentration of nickel. Now, the surface rocks have about five times as much nickel as the Martian meteorites do. And we have tried to make a model of how this could have arisen, assuming that both the meteorites and the surface rocks originally were produced by melting within Mars's interior. And the only way that we can do this is by assuming that the surface rocks were melted in a more, or produced in a more oxygen-rich environment in Mars's interior. That means that the meteorites would have to come from a region of the interior which is relatively low in oxygen. The surface rocks would come from a region which is relatively high in oxygen.
You talk about a process that took place that sort of recycles surface rocks back into the interior and then back to the surface again. What is that?
Well, on Earth, we know that the way that we introduce oxidized materials, oxygen-rich materials, into the interior of the Earth is through subduction. And that's the process whereby old oceanic crust is pushed back down into the mantle, into the interior. But we know that that introduces oxidized material into the interior on Earth, and that oxidized material has an effect on the volcanic products that come out of volcanoes, for example, in Chile or the west coast of the U.S. in the Cascades. So we know that that process takes place on Earth, and we've proposed that it took place on early Mars as well, and that oxidized material from the surface was pushed back into the interior and had an effect on the volcanic liquids that were produced in the interior.
Generally accepted that the reddish hue of Mars' surface was the result of oxidation, which in itself should indicate the presence of oxygen at least at one time. Where did Mars get its oxygen? I know here on Earth we got it from basically photosynthesis of microbes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course, it would be very interesting if one could assert that the same thing, that microbes were involved on Mars. But in fact, the principal origin of oxygen was probably from the breakdown of water into oxygen plus hydrogen. This happens in the atmosphere all the time. It's happening on Earth right now, that the water is broken down into oxygen plus hydrogen, and some hydrogen escapes from the Earth, leaving a small amount of remaining oxygen in the atmosphere. This process had to have happened on Mars too, if there was water vapor in the Martian atmosphere. The big difference is that on Mars, it's easier for the hydrogen to escape because Mars has lower gravity. It depends on the gravity of the planet. As long as there was water around on Mars and water vapor in the atmosphere, there would be continuous production of oxygen due to the breakdown of water into oxygen plus hydrogen. What causes the breakdown is radiation from the sun. Mars's atmosphere has disappeared by reaction with the rocks at the surface. As you know, Mars is red, and that is because of the production of iron oxide, and that is where the oxygen that was in the atmosphere has gone. The water that was present in early Mars has also gone by reaction with the rocks. Now, that process is happening on Earth all the time as well. So water is consumed, carbon dioxide is to some extent consumed, and oxygen is consumed by reaction between oceans and atmospheres and the rocks. But on Earth, there is continuous production of more water, more carbon dioxide, which comes up with volcanoes. So volcanic liquids, as they're generated, they dissolve water and carbon in them. And when they are erupted on the surface, they release that water and carbon as carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So there is continual replenishment on Earth of the water and carbon dioxide, which is consumed by reaction. On Earth, we consume the water and the carbon dioxide by reaction with the rocks, and then new volcanic materials coming up from the interior bring with them a replacement water and replacement carbon dioxide. Now, on Mars, one presumes that the same process would have happened early on in Mars's history, but Mars has cooled, has become cooler very much more rapidly than Earth has. Mars is a small planet and it has cooled down. And as it cooled down, the amount of volcanism reduced, the water and carbon dioxide were not replaced efficiently. And eventually, the amount of water and carbon dioxide being replaced by this process into the atmosphere would have become very small. And so gradually the water and carbon dioxide would have been consumed and Mars's atmosphere would have got thinner and thinner. Mars' surface became colder and colder and we had a kind of a negative greenhouse effect.
That was Professor Bernard Wood from Oxford University in the United Kingdom. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.